actually, who determines history? The crowd or the individual? Who makes history? Who makes history? This one. Who makes history? You know Carlyle's opinion that individuals make history. Napoleon made history. Napoleon hadn't been born. Who knows? History would have had a different... there would be a different historical destiny, a European destiny, and so forth. And you know, Marxism insists that history is made by the crowd, by the masses. It doesn't matter, I mean, by the class, by the labor, a classless society, by labor, all that doesn't matter. What's our Jewish viewpoint about it? Sometimes I'm inclined to accept Carlyle's theory that the individual makes history. If in 1956, Eisenhower had been president in 1956, with his state secretary, the idiot Dulles, we would have had all problems pertaining to the state of Israel resolved. That time when they joined Russia in condemning, I mean, the occupation of the Sinai Peninsula and the insistence with which they demanded that France and England, the Jews and Israel should retreat, withdraw, you know, and Israel complied with the demand. Eisenhower went on radio and so forth. That's responsible for all the troubles in there. Of course, the individual has a great influence, no doubt about it. But who makes it? What is Jewish viewpoint about history? Of course, God makes it. What is the instrument? Of course, this is true. God makes history, and he is Ish Mohammed. What I mean, he employs man as instruments, as the tools with which he realizes his will, his scheme. So who plays an important role? Who plays the important role? The individual or the community, let me say, or the crowd? The community or the crowd, who plays the important role? It's very hard, I mean, to accept one theory and reject the other one. I mean, there is some truth to both of them. I don't know, I'll just quote a medrash for you, and I believe the medrash will tell you what resolve the problem. Vav gamzeis b'yesom b'eretz v'yem. למאסתים ולגאלתים וחליסום לא פבריס איתום כעני עד השם הלכם כעני השם הלכם. And even though when they'll be in the land of their enemies, I have not rejected them, nor have I forsaken them, because I remember the covenant of Amitah. It's not on the Midrash, the Gemara already says. ועם גם זה יסבייסם בארץ אליהם ומאסתים שמדתי להם מורדכי ואסתר בשושן אביר. I haven't rejected them because I gave them מורדכי and אסתר בשושן אביר. It was a time of crisis. Time of crisis. לחליסם ולגאלתים שמדתי להם מתיסיו ובונב. I gave them מתיסיו and his children. In the time of the Maccabim, in order to help them. The Gealti, Lofabris, Itom, the Gemara says, so the Medra says, Shemaditilem Rebbe, the Chavera. The Rebbe was very friendly with the governor of Israel, the Roman governor, and he protected the community from many cruel edicts and ruthless policies. It's very strange. The Medrash tries to explain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though he exiled the people from Eretz Yisrael and they were dispersed all over the world, but in times of crisis, in times when disaster was near, was about to strike, he protected them. So the Medrash could have said, I haven't rejected them. I have helped them. I helped them simply Haman failed in carrying out his plan, and then Lofa Brisiton, like Galtin, Lofa Brisiton, which have said, Sheshaiteison Bimechash Menoim, I helped them. The Medrash did not say that God helped them, and that's why it's a proof that God has never forgotten, forsaken the people. But the Medrash says, I gave them in certain individuals. I gave them Mordechai Esther, I gave them Matisyahu Bonov, I gave them Ezra Vechaverov, Rebbe Vechaverov. You see, what you derive from that Medrash is that it is the individual plays a very important role. It's not in conflict with what I said before, that later when the individual discharges his duty, he retreats into anonymity. But as long as the individual is necessary and his presence is indispensable, so the individual plays a great role here. And sometimes, for instance, if Mordechai had not been in Shushan HaBirah, and Esther, I mean, hadn't been the queen, I mean, certain events which actually led up to her selection as queen, if certain events hadn't taken place, the Jews would have been in terrible dilemma, you understand very well, I mean. So the role of the individual, and the fact that Matisyahu lived in that, in a certain era, in a certain epoch, was the gift of God. The individual inspires the crowd. The individual is the prophet who arouses the crowd, the community. The final accomplishment belongs to the community. But however, the individual is the teacher, you see. When Carlyle spoke about hero, there are no heroes in Jewish history. There's only one hero in Jewish history. His name is Almighty. Hashem Gibra Muhammad. There are no heroes in Jewish history. Human heroes don't exist. We've never worshipped heroes. We've never deified heroes. Take for instance the German history, they deified heroes. And the same is true in Greek mythology. I mean, they deified heroes. The Jew has never deified any hero. He always knew that the greatest of heroes is a human being. As my man, as Chazal say, Hayim Khan today is here on the Mokho Bekeran, tomorrow is in the grave. I mean, there's no hero worship. But however, as I said before, there is gratitude, there is appreciation, not idolization, but appreciation, gratitude. The individual is the teacher, not the prophet, the teacher, not the hero. He inspires, he arouses, he leads. And then, I mean, the community takes over. When the Jews, for instance, have made a golden calf, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Lech Reid, descend. So the Medrash says, Kulum Nasati Lo Gdulo, I bestowed glory upon thee, Elo Bishvil Yisroel, not for your sake, but for the sake of the community. If the community has committed a sin and lost its glory, so you cannot retain your glory. You have to descend. It's a strange combination. The individual is important, not as a hero, as a teacher. What is Matisyahu a teacher? Interesting is Chazal speak of Matisyahu one of as Bezdin Hashmenoi, the Bezdin of the Hashmenoi. As if Matisyahu one of who were what shall I say, Rabbonim. That being Rabbonim, I mean, who and they comprise the Bezdin. As a matter of fact, there are many halachas which the Gemara attributes to Bezdin Shel Hashmenoi. Many halachas, many laws, takonis, interpretations, which the Gemara attributes to Bezdin Shel Hashmenoi. He is the teacher, not the hero. As a teacher, the individual is very important. So the relation, even David HaMelech. You know, when you study the Gemara Brachas about David, so you get the impression that Chazal had a tendency to portray David not as a king, as a warrior, but as a Rosh Yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva. So David, and it's not the fault of Chazal. In T'man Ye'ape, when you read T'man Ye'ape, this psalm, and David describes himself, portrays himself as a teacher, as a student. The teacher is more interested in law, in halacha, then in strategy and military strategy or warfare. Okay. Why did Chazal do it? Why did Chazal try to project an image of David, which prima facie is incomprehensible? David is the great warrior, the hero on the field of battle. David and Joab and Yeov, I mean, two pals, two friends, commander-in-chief, who united the Eretz Israel, the Jewish people, and they extended the borders of Eretz Israel, both south and north, and in the east. I mean, why is it? Because the greatest person in Yehadus is the teacher, not the king. Not the king. We are not interested in kings. And if we respect the king, and if we appreciate him, and if we remember him his love and tenderness, it's because the king becomes the teacher. Because already in Chumash, Boye b'shifti al kisei mamlachtei, as soon as they'll sit down on his throne, the kosav leis mishne atev azeis, right away he has to order that somebody should write for him the Sefer Torah, the Korot beikol yemei chayav, and he should study the Torah all his life without interruption. He's already the king, is the scholar. It's not the Platonic philosopher, very far. It's not that. There's nothing in common. But the king is the great teacher. David Sheves Tach Kemeni, the Gemara says, David spent his time in debates, in halachic debates, the teacher. The Hashmonaim were also teachers. And that's matasko. Because we don't believe in just arousing people emotionally. We don't believe in that. We don't believe in this revivalist method. It's a Christian, it's an old Christian approach, revivalism. It goes back to the early period of Christianity. They never taught anybody. Christians, they never taught anybody. They tried to indoctrinate, to brainwash, to inspire, by performing miracles and whatnot. Their relationship was a purely emotional one. If you study the gospel, you see. While in Yehadus, we never tried to inspire. We've always tried to teach. There's a lot to be taught in Yehadus. Matasko, because Matisyo was the great teacher. And as a teacher, the individual plays a great role. But there is one difference between the teacher and the hero. The teacher must have his students. There is no teacher without students. And the worth of the teacher is always dependent, the value of the teacher, upon the students. They determine the value, they appreciate it. And that is what Matisyo was. Matisyo. Chazal call him Bezden Shel Chashmonai. Never Chashmonai, Bezden Shel Chashmonai. You see, the Bezden, the court, or the Sanhedrin of the Chashmonai. Matisyo apparently was the Reish Bezden, the chief justice, so to say. Now let's continue. Malchus Yobon Osho. Malchus Yobon Osho, the wicked kingdom of Yovan. Yovan is Greece, of course. Actually, it wasn't Greece, I told you. It was in the post-Alexandrian period when his empire fell apart, disintegrated. And the Syrian kingdom, his branch, actually invaded the Near East. So why do you call it Malchus Yovan Osho? The authors of the Alanisim knew very well who the enemy was. Didn't make a mistake. They didn't. They were not ignorant of the fact that, I mean, that the enemy did not consist of Greeks, of genuine Greeks. It's another people, another kind of race, who knows what kind of a race it was at that time, which were just assimilated into the Greek culture. They assimilated the Greek language, most probably, probably the higher strata of society. I don't believe that everybody spoke Greek at that time. But the higher the intelligentsia, the ruling class probably spoke Greek. They used to be dressed like Greeks. Their habits and mores were Greek, Hellenistic. That's all. Why does the Mechaber, whoever he was, the author, quite possible that he was a contemporary of the Cheshbonoim, who knows, classify, identify them as Greeks, Malchus Yovan also. Why blame Yovan for something which Yovan has never committed, done, for a crime which Yovan in Greece has never committed? Somebody else committed it. Why is it called Malchus Yovan also? It's not a mistake, it's not an error. I mean, I told the thought with them, they knew where they are. I mean, they knew very well who they are and what they are. I mean, the Maccabees knew very well who their enemy was. It was no problem of misrepresentation or why did the identity of the enemy is Malchus Yovan Osho? Why? Basically, what happened that time? What happened? What was new in history, in Jewish history, in the pre-Maccabean period? I don't mean pre-Maccabean, before the war broke out. What was? Something strange happened. It was the first time the Jewish history was confronted with something new. With something new, with a new phenomenon. With something which simply the contemporaries of Matisseau couldn't understand. It was a new experience, a strange alien experience. What happened? The first time in Jewish annals, then it appeared and reoccurred, I mean, quite frequently. What was new? No. Night of Joseph Zirin, I mean, happened during Achofstein and the whole Tanakh is. No. Religious persecution. We have never met with religious persecution to prevent Jews from observing the law and make them violate the basic principles of Yahadut. It's the first experience in the Jewish annals. Before that, religious persecution was unknown. The first time that you call Redifes Hadas, religious persecution. That was the first time. Before, you don't know. All right, I mean, there were times of deviationism in Jewish history, yes, thought idolatry and so forth. Deviationism. But persecution of those who wanted to observe, to abide, this was the first experience with which our people met in the pre-Maccabean period. There was no religious persecution in Jewish annals before that, the first time. And basically, many laws pertaining to Kiddush Hashem, and Kulach Nefesh, question is if somebody actually, a tyrant, forces a Jew to violate the law, what is the Jew supposed to do under the threat of death? Should he incur death, martyrdom, and observe the law, or should he give in for a while? I mean, all the laws, Yorek Valyaver, Yaver Valyorek, of course, they were later formulated in the time, in the post-Better, the post-Bar Kochma debacle, but the laws were formed, the beginning of the laws is to be found in the pre-Maccabean period. The Jew already was confronted with a new problem, a new shaila. How should he act? If some tyrant tells him, either you worship the idol, or you'll be killed. And he said, Kiddush Hashem. The problem of Kiddush Hashem I mean, emerged in the prima Maccabean period. And thus, of course, the fact that they defiled the Beis HaMikdash was not because of carelessness, no. It was a malicious act. It was a part of the scheme of Rebbitzin Sadara, of the religious persecution. Yes, now, what was it due to? Why? Responsible for it is Greek, is the Greek culture. The disdain, because when Alexander Magnus, actually, when Alexander Magnus began to extend his empire, and he wanted to conquer, he had a dream of conquering the world, and he was killed on his march to the India. But when his dream was not just a dream of conquering the world, they're very strange. The same was not a dream just of conquering the world for the sake of conquest, for the sake of power. He was a missionary. A missionary from whom? For Greek culture. To bring the Greek message or the Greek gospel to every primitive barbarian tribe or nation. And the whole world consists of barbarians. So the whole world was, you know, divided into two sects, into two groups, the Hellenes and the barbarians. And his job was to civilize the world. As the British Empire later, they tried to do at least. Yeah. The British Empire, also Germany, not during Hitler's time, but in 1914, the First World War, when Germany declared the war on England and France and Russia, it also was imbued with the spirit, with the missionary spirit, to bring the German culture, the Deutsche Kultur, to all barbarian people. Yeah. Who is barbarian, ever is not a German, and does not wear a uniform of the Reichswehr. This was Alexander Magnus, and that exactly when the people get, I mean, develops a fixation of mission, there is one exemption to that rule, exception to that rule. The Jew, now explain to you why. When the people develop, I mean, the idea of mission, that I have to conquer the world in order to civilize it, or in order to raise mankind in a state of barbarity and primitiveness to that of civilization and culture, religious persecution is inevitable, because the barbarians don't want to be taught. And the barbarians think that their code, moral code, is just as good as that of Plato and Aristotle. I told them, forget, Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander Magnus. You see. And that their morality is as high as that of the cultured and sophisticated Greeks. So when you begin, they refuse to accept the moral code, the gospel which is offered by the Greeks. So once they refuse to accept the moral code, the gospel which is offered by the Greeks, so what is the result? Persecution. You try to enforce it. You try to impose it. And that leads to persecution. That was truly with regard to Christianity too. Christianity is also a missionary religion. We are not a missionary religion. We don't want to bring our Bible to the entire world. We have never tried. On the contrary, we are reluctant to accept Gerim. I mean, you know what's going on out in Israel now. If somebody would come to the priest, he wants to convert to Christianity, he would do it immediately. But on the contrary, I mean, they are trying, I mean, to snatch souls, as many as possible. But here come the Geyeres, the Rabbanim Yisrael, they say, come back in a year, in 2 years. All right, that's what it is. The UN cries in Yisrael, the Rabbanim are machmirim as far as conversion is concerned. We are reluctant to accept Gerim. We are reluctant, for many reasons, and a variety of things. Anyway, yes. So we have never been a missionary. We got it here for ourselves. We don't want to sell it to anybody else. No export business. We don't want, I mean, to raise the mankind from primitiveness to an exalted position of humanity. We don't want. We are not missionaries. Had we been missionaries, we could have captured the world, you know. Had we been missionaries, So Rome, when Rome was about to shake off idolatry, during the twilight period of Rome, when there are hundreds and hundreds of aristocratic families which converted to Judaism, even the imperial family had members who secretly, clandestinely, professed Judaism. If we were a missionary people, we would have proselytized Rome, not the Christians. And if we had proselytized Rome, you know what would have happened? So Europe would have been Jewish. I always think about it, what image? what the kind of Judaism which would have evolved if actually we had converted Rome to Judaism? Perhaps the whole world would be a different one. Perhaps the destiny of mankind would be different. I don't know. But we were not a missionary people. That there is no religious persecution now, Reynolds has started, so you should be the persecutor and force other people. On the contrary, the Rambam says, you cannot tell a non-Jew to observe Jewish law, because the Jewish law was given to the Jew. He has no right to impose it. All you can demand from other people is to observe the seven mitzvahs. Seven mitzvahs are the foundation of civilized life. Against idolatry, murder, incest, the requirement for a civil code, for civilized life, there should be justice, that's all. Because we are not a missionary people. And then we could have captured the East, the Orient. It was before Muhammad came. Also, the Arab tribes, the many Arab tribes, which were primitive idolaters, pagans, began to doubt the worth and the value of their polytheistic religion. And there were many converts to Judaism already in Arabia. As a matter of fact, in Medina there were many. And Mohammed anti-Semitism was due to the fact that the Jews opposed him. If the Jews had been more dynamic, more mission conscious, and more aggressive and bolder, they would have converted all Arabs to Judaism. Again, I'm asking, what kind of a Jew we would have now? But it is true. You see, the Maimon Chazal, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu came and offered the Torah to Esau, which means Rome. Esau is always Rome. And he offered the Torah to the Yishmael Bnei Leit, and that is the Arab population. It's not just a story. It's not just a story, it is history. There was a time when there was a distinct possibility to convert Esau, means Rome, to Judaism. And by converting Esau to Judaism, we would have conquered the European continent. Because Rome was the center of civilization and culture. But somehow we have not succeeded. And the reason is because we are not missionaries. There's a lack of aggressiveness on our part. We are not bold. We are more inner-directed, introspective as a group. And we are not interested in the world. So we are now 40 million people. That's all. It could have been 500 million. And that's exactly Alexander Magnus. He was the first missionary, actually. He combined military tactics with Greek culture. He conquered the land not only to control the land politically, but to implant Greek culture, Greek ideas, Greek code of ethics, and so forth. Of course, he failed. He failed miserably, but those who succeeded him still retained the idea of spreading and disseminating Greek culture, philosophy. And of course, Judea refused. Judea resisted, did not succumb. So religious persecution was initiated. Our refusal to comply with the missionary complex of the Syriacs, Hellenized Syriacs, actually was the reason for introducing religious persecution. So basically the people are not Greeks, but who is responsible for it? The Greek mentality, the Greek culture, Greek vanity, Greek pride, the idea that the whole world consists of barbarians, only the Hellenes are cultured. The matter of fact is very important. I told it last year to somebody from me. On the hierarchy in Rome, from the Catholic hierarchy in Rome. He asked me a question. He said, he said that they are not only responsible for the Hitler Holocaust, but more than that, they helped Jews during the Hitler period. Listen, in terms of statistics, it's very hard to contradict him, some did help, some didn't. The Poles, the priesthood in Poland were cooperated, with certain exceptions, with the Nazi, with the Gestapo cooperated. As a matter of fact, I read the memoirs of a Jew who was disguised as a Catholic and a Goy during the Hitler occupation of Poland, and he once came to confess for confession, and he confessed to the priest that he doesn't know. He said he doesn't know whether it was a sin or it's a goodie that he saved the Jew, he protected the Jew and prevented him from falling into the hands of the Gestapo. So the priest told him it's a venial sin and he should repent, and next time when he sees a Jew he should deliver him to the Gestapo. I mean, the Jew later wrote memoirs. There were certain priests who helped Jews. Not too many, there were. In Italy, the situation was much better. Italian priests were helpful. Not all of them, certainly. And so forth. To say that the Catholic Church actually stood up, and protected the Jew courageously would be a gross exaggeration. But I told him something else. I said, I can't argue with you about the statistics, numbers, I don't know. It's very hard to guess. I know of certain incidents, both positive and negative incidents. I cannot argue. But I told him something else. Of course Hitler was not a Christian. He kept on telling me Hitler was not a Christian. Of course he was not a Christian. He was a pagan. He was worse than pagan, Hitler. Yeah, of course. Hitler's group, his friends, and none of them were the pious Christian, observant Christian, no doubt about it. He himself was a Catholic, so was Goebbels, and so was, I believe, Goering. I don't remember about Goering. Anyway, but I told him about something else. If we think about the Hitler Holocaust, that millions of Christians, decent people, civilized people, cultured people, Germany, France, Holland, and so far the Baltic countries have witnessed the slaughter of 6 million Jews, among them little babies, infants. They used to swing them against the brick wall and smash their skulls. Yes. How is it possible? After all, people sometimes cannot see a wounded dog without getting excited and trying to help the dog. Could see actually the murder, systematic murder, extermination of old men, middle-aged children, and infants. It is due to something else. It is due to the preaching of the church throughout the centuries and millennia, throughout the past 1900 years, that the Jew was cursed by God because he rejected Christ. The Jew is a wandering Jew, has no home. And the Jew is responsible for the fact that Christ has not come back, a second time. He was supposed to, but I tell you. He hasn't, And the Jew, finally, the idea that the Jew is subhuman is a Catholic idea. Of course, you may point out a few theologians in the Catholic Church who are more conscientious and more careful, but usually this is the concept of the Jew, which was supported, not cultivated, by the church and implanted in the Catholic, in the Christian by the church. Now, of course, now perhaps you realize that it was a mistake, an error, a terrible error. Hitler was not a Catholic. But if not for your doctrine of the eternal Jew and the wandering Jew, and if not for your continual preaching about the Jew, that he is, so to say, he blocks actually the arrival of your Messiah, the Hitler Holocaust couldn't have taken place. You are not perhaps directly responsible, but indirectly you are responsible. You are the culprit, you are the guilty. If not a story about Christ killer and deicide and the wandering Jew who renounced the stories about Judas, and with Judas you identify every Jew. I mean, such cruelty couldn't have taken place. Couldn't have taken place. Directly perhaps you're right. You're not responsible. Hitler, I wouldn't call him a Christian. But indirectly, it is your fault. And I say it with regard to Marcus Yovan Arisho. Indirectly, Greece was not responsible for the religious problem. Directly. Like when there were bunched out enough wild Syriacs, who knows what kind of a race they were. I mean, we don't know that, who they were. But certainly it didn't belong to the Hellenes, not the other. Hitler, I wouldn't call him a Christian. But indirectly, it is your fault. And I say it with regard to Marcus Yovan Arisho. Indirectly, Greece was not responsible for the religious problem. Directly. Like when there were bunched out enough wild Syriacs, who knows what kind of a race they were. I mean, we don't know that, who they were. But certainly it didn't belong to the Hellenes, not otherwise. But indirectly, it is the Alexander of Mission. The pride of the Greeks, I mean, your contempt for everybody else but Greek. Kesheomdo Malchus Yovan Arisho Alamcho Yisrael. Let me in Kesheomdo. Well, let's move on. What it means Kesheomdo? Kesheomdo Malchus Yovan Arisho Alamcho Yisrael. What does it mean, Keshe Omdo? What do you say? What? No, but plainly literal. What does it mean, Keshe Omdo, Marcus? Rose up. To what? Why do you have to rise? There's no need to rise. What does it mean, Keshe Omdo, Marcus? Of course, literally means Keshe Omdo rose against thy people. When the wicked Greek kingdom rose against thy people, yes. But what is Kishomdo? What does Kishomdo mean? There were many terms which could have been used. Kishomdo means determination. Not just a decision. A decision sometimes, you carry out, and sometimes you renege. You change your mind. What if there is a determination that it's got to be done? And that's a major objective of mine, you say Keshe Omdo. For instance, for Hitler, I want you to understand, for Hitler, anti-Semitism was not a secondary policy or some peripheral approach. No, a peripheral philosophy. This was the major objective in the whole philosophy, in the wicked philosophy of Nazism, is the destruction of the Jew was a major objective. As for instance, atheism is Marxism. We don't understand it. Why is it necessary for Marxism and socialism to adapt in an atheist philosophy? But I don't know. It's a different problem. I don't know. But atheism in Marxism and communism is not just incidental, to say, a peripheral doctrine. No. It is the very foundation of Marxism, of communism. Why it is so, I don't know. I could never understand. Well, you know, there in Germany they used to have the religious, the socialists. But they've never succeeded in attracting the masses. The communist socialist society is an atheist society, and to them atheism is actually a religion itself. It's a kind of an idol, and it means to the Malchus, Yovanov, Shoah, whoever it was the religious persecution or the destruction of Jewish identity was not just incidental. It wasn't incidental. It was a major object. And I want you to know that anti-Semitism for the Christian, who is an anti-Semite, and I am far from being the one to look for anti-Semites under the table or under the bed, or to identify, for instance, hooliganism on New York streets with anti-Semitism. To exaggerate is dangerous. Be careful. Not every act of a criminal or a hooligan, be black, be white, is to be classified as anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is not hooliganism, I want you to know. It's very far from being hooliganism. I know what anti-Semitism is. Anti-Semitism can be very civilized. Civilized and sophisticated and very refined. I mean, you don't know, Baruch Hashem, you don't know what anti-Semitism is. So you identify it with the wrong phenomena, not hooliganism. That's why this type of exaggeration is unhealthy, and it endangers our status in the United States. I mean, this recent fear. I don't know who aroused that fear in us. But with this recent fear that our future here is not yet yours, is very unhealthy for American Jews. You don't have to convince the Goy that he's not so much. What the American Jew is doing now is trying to convince the Goy that they don't love him. It's a dangerous matter. I know in my private life, I've never tried to convince somebody that he's my enemy. If he told me he's my friend, I accept it. Whether I believe him or not is a different story, but I accept it. But to try hard with the grubby finger, and the commentary does it now, the August commentary on her, yes, that the Jews are insecure in the United States. You see, the commentary is a paper which represents assimilation, you know. But suddenly it's spreading panic among the Jews in the United States. Trying to convince the Jew, the Goy actually, that he's not sincere when he says that he is a friend of the Jew. Anyway, let's forget about it. So you understand me? Anti-Semitism in general, for an anti-Semitic movement, is anti-Semitism never incidental, never peripheral, marginal. It's central. It's very strange, we don't know why. Or it was in Germany, the Deutsche National Party. The Deutsche National Party was a conservative. They represented the capitalists in Germany, industrially. There was no need for the Deutsche National to be anti-Semite. But they were anti-Semite. And anti-Semitism was the central idea in their, so to say, political world outlook. Political philosophy. And that's exactly Kishondo Malchus Yovan. It means determination. It means centrality. Not just incidental. Malchus Yovan had many problems. But one of the problems was, I mean, the subjugation of the spirit of the proud Judeans who did not want to surrender to the Greek culture. No, it was not. Kishondo means all the deeds, all the thought. Everything was directed just toward one ultimate goal, namely to subjugate the Jew. This is the word Kishondo Malchus Yovan. Determined, relentless, inconsiderate. It's very strange. It's one of the strange phenomena in history why anti-Semitism plays such an important role. There was no need for Hitler to be an anti-Semite, actually. He could have gotten everything without being an anti-Semite. It's quite possible if he hadn't been anti-Semite, he would have gotten everything and a little more than he had, because he might have won the war. Driving out the Jewish scientists of Germany, he could have gotten the atomic bomb before America. It's quite possible. Anti-Semitism actually is responsible for Hitler's downfall. Of course, he fell before the atomic bomb was invented, was manufactured, produced, but he could have gotten it. He could have. It's quite possible. But this is Kishon, the Mahasyon on Oshor. Alamcho Yisrael. What does it mean, Alamcho Yisrael? Two plain words that don't require any interpretation. Alamcho Yisrael. Where they have the same expression. Where does the same expression recur? The commentary of Gorecki, where does the same expression Amcho Yisroel recur? Yeah. Chotu Ovu Poshe Lefanecho Amcho Yisroel Kapano Lechatoim Velavenis Velapshoim Sheposhu Veshechotu Sheovu Lefanecho Shechotu Sheovu Sheposhu Lefanecho Amcho Yisroel. What does Amcho Yisroel mean? Of course, thy people Israel. Of course, it's so simple. Yeah. What does Amcho mean? Umika Amcho Yisroel Geechot Boret. Also here. There is emphasis. Kishom Dom Machas Yolom Orsho Alam Yisroel. We don't say Alam Yisroel. We say Al Amcho Yisroel. We could have said Kishom Dom Machas Yolom Orsho Al Yisroel. It's perfect. Or Kishom Dom Machas Yolom Orsho Al Amcho. Or Alam Yisrael. No. None of those terms was chosen. The proper expression apparently is Alamcho Yisrael. What does Amcho Yisrael express? Yes, yes, yes. This is correct. This is the Ramban says so in Azino. That the hatred of the Jew is not because the enemy does not like the Jew, due to some physiological traits or physiognomy, it doesn't like the nose or the color of the eyes or the hair of the Jew. It's because the Jew is committed. The Ramban says it's Nazir, because the Jew is committed to God. So basically, the enemy of the Jew is the enemy of God. And it's not only the Ramban. Chazal says, "Kumu ad Hashem v'yefutzu evecho v'yenusu misanecho miponecho." Who are the enemies of God? I mean, what do you mean speaking enemy of God? What can the enemies do to God? So Rashi right there in Bamidbar says, Zeu Eileim Oseinu Yisroel. Kol Oseinu Yisroel, Nikro Oseinu Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're correct. But there is something else to it. Amcho means we belong to thee. Amcho is a possessive noun, you know very well. You belong to thee. We belong to thee even while we go astray and deviate from the righteous path. We are still committed to thee, but even when we are guilty of certain offenses and of certain sins. In Amcho, what comes to expression in Amcho is the old idea. The old idea. Yisroel afa pishechoto, choto Yisroel. Yisroel afa pishechoto, Yisroel. The Jew, even when he sins, he remains a Jew. What does it mean? What did Chazal, Rashi quotes it. What did Chazal want to express with this expression? Afa pishechoto Yisroel. It means there is an eternal commitment in the Jew to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes it's a conscious commitment. Sometimes it's an unconscious commitment. But there is a commitment which can never be annulled, can never be severed. That commitment is like a load, like a heavy load, pressing upon the frail shoulders of every Jew. He might fight this commitment. He might hate this commitment. But there is a commitment on the part of every Jew. A Jew is always, basically there is actually, they extend it to men in general, but now we are not interested in that angle. They make it a universal trait that man is committed to God. But we are not interested in the universal angle. We are interested now in the particular angle as far as the Jew is concerned. The Jew basically cannot cast off. It will completely, strip him of his inner joy and glory. He loses spiritual personality. Chabad call it Havu Ativis, the natural love for God that the Jew possesses. Whether he was trained or he wasn't trained, whether he wants to love God or he doesn't want, there is a natural instinctual drive, urge to find God in the Jew. Many Jews who walk straight to that ultimate goal move in the right direction. Some Jews are searching for God, but they move in their search, they move in the opposite direction. Of course, they are lost sheep. But this is the natural, spontaneous drive in man, urge in man for God. But it comes to expression, there's more vigor in the Jew. This is Amcho. We belong to the, there is no way how we can free ourselves from the Al Amcho Israel. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you frankly, some people may think it is just a beautiful idea, but it's practically not correct. And many a time I thought so. I began to think to somehow to approach this idea of Havo Tivis or Amcho. It means compulsory belonging on the part of the Jew to God. Willy-nilly belongs to it. So I began to doubt that outlook, that philosophy. When I came to America, and there was a tremendous assimilationist movement in America. It was assimilation in its ugliest and most vulgar form. Particularly the first immigrants who came to America, and they gave up everything. And then you thought that Russian Jewry is completely lost. And there was no general commitment on the part of the Jew. We were in a small minority, limited minority, observant Jews. There was no institution of chinuch in the United States. Yet a couple of day schools, you could never reach. In some towns, and they were also disorganized and batlones, they were conducted in a very batlones way, completely. You couldn't be too optimistic about the philosophy of Amcho. That finally the philosophy of Amcho. I am dying, willy-nilly. I belong to thee, whether I want it or I don't want. Kayol tarek nafshia, kayol tarek alfikimoyin ki nafshi tarek lecho. I'm like the gazelle who is thirsty for water. So I'm thirsty for God. It means spontaneously, instinctually. I began to simply to doubt whether it is true or not, even though it's a basic concept in Yehadus. It doesn't go back to Chazal. Chazal developed it beautifully. Beautifully, particularly D'Artagnan, the Likudei Tehillim. Well, but it's an old. It's an old idea. It's very optimistic. Vayim ahu yitok ha-beshef ha-godel bo-evdim beretzashu v'nedochim beretz Mitzrayim. It means the day of remembrance or of the day of awakening will arrive sooner or later. And the Shefa Godel might be an external sound, might be an internal sound, an inner sound rather. Whether there is a Shefa who frighten the man or his conscience will inspire him, arouse him, I don't know. And even the Evdim, the people who are considered lost, Beretz Asher or Beretz Mitzrayim, will come back. But now two things happened lately which actually corroborate the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael. One thing, if it is true, I don't know, I'm still skeptical, if there is really awakening among the Russian Jews. If it is true, I don't know. They tell me people who come from Russia, I spoke with many Russian Jews, they tell me it is true. I still am skeptical. You know why I'm skeptical? Because it borders on the miraculous. Don't forget the revolution in Russia took place in 1917. November 1917. All right, now we are, Baruch Hashem, 1972. So it means two generations were raised in Russian schools, atheist, from A to Z, materialistic in outlook on the world, on man, and particularly resentful. I don't know why, coming in resentful of Judaism, very resentful. I don't know why. In my opinion, it is most probably due to the fact that communism is a philosophy of atheism, as I told you. Atheism is not something marginal, incidental. It's basic and central to communism. And the Jew is the man who gave to the world monotheism. And a philosophy, a world, a community founded upon atheism must hate a community which has brought to the world the gospel of faith in God. But whatever it is, they were raised as communists, as members of the Russian society. And this awakening is taking place in Russia. And again I emphasize, I have doubts whether it is true, that it's just a phenomenon which is limited to a small segment of Russian Jewry, or it is a movement. But if it is a movement, is the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael correct 100%? If after, I would say, 53, 54 years of Russian education and training, young men are ready to cast off, to shed the whole philosophy of communism and go to Eretz Yisrael and identify themselves as Jews, so apparently there is something to the Jew which is indicative of Amcho. We belong to the willy-nilly, and no one can take us away from him. It's very strange, because acknowledgement of being a Jew, be it secular, be it religious, is ipso facto an acknowledgement of belonging to God. This is number one. Number two, which fortifies my faith in the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael, is the remarkable commitment on the part of the American Jew to the State of Israel. It's also a miracle to me. I told you many times, because it's not so simple. It's not, all right, not a question of just sympathy. It's a question of disagreeing with the government of the United States. And we do demand from the government of the United States to adopt a policy in the Near East which is friendly toward Israel, don't we? Of course we are. And the American Jew of the 30s, whom I found when I came here, was not ready for that. He was not ready for that. He would have never taken the risk. Never. It is something new to the American Jew. The new sense of pride, the new sense of courage, and particularly the new awareness of his own identity. When you have that awareness of your own identity, you know something else. As no matter how distinct we are, and no matter how many languages we speak, and no matter how remote we are from each other geographically, there is a common destiny for all Jews throughout the globe. The American Jew did not have it years ago, not even the 40s during the Hitler Holocaust. Had the American Jew had the same awareness as he has now, perhaps millions of Jews would have been saved. He would have stormed the White House. When Roosevelt refused to receive a delegation of rabbis in 1943-44, when the extermination of Jews in Europe reached its height, I mean, if the Jews of 1944 acted the way Jewish youth acts now with regard to Russia, which is incomparably different. You cannot say. Perhaps he could have succeeded in persuading, or at least, I mean, forcing Roosevelt to act. And if Roosevelt had acted, he could have saved a million Jews. That time I thought, actually, in the 40s, that the American Jew has forgotten the Amcho. Forgotten the Amcho. Now, I'm encouraged, and I begin to believe that there is something, some metamorphosis has taken place in the American Jewish community. It is more serious than you imagine. There is pride, there is courage, and particularly, I said, there is the awareness, the clear awareness, that I belong to the people. The great people, the eternal people, and our destiny and commitment is one. Our one. This is Mika. Omdo al Amcho. And of course, because Amcho, then is Yisrael, it's beautiful. That's what what is Yisrael? What does Yisrael mean? What's the word? What's the semantics of Yisrael? We just read it say, 2 weeks ago. What is the semantics of Yisrael? Kisoriso melekim vanoshim vatuchal. What does it mean? You have contended, struggled, wrestled with rekim, with angels, means with powerful enemy, almost omnipotent enemy, the manoshim, with powerful, influential people, vatuchal. And in spite of all pessimistic predictions, you emerge victorious. Why? Because Amcho. Because there is a certain commitment on our part to God and to the people that no power in the world can break it. And if you have that commitment, you are very powerful. If you have that commitment, you are very powerful. What was the secret of the victory of the Hashmonaim? I mean, all right. Helped by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the secret was, because the Hashmonaim knew, we are Amcho. And if we are Amcho, we can never sever our affiliation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Never. Even though the affiliation is the source of pain and despair and suffering and misery, and certainly it's not a source of comfort and convenience. But still we belong to him. So that gives power to a person. Absolute commitment is actually, I mean, is perhaps the strongest weapon that the individual and the community may wield. Because we are Amcho, we are Israel. We contend with many and we prevail. After all, Buber said that Apostle Klayovik Ishime Adalisa Shocha is central in Yahadus. I don't know how he explains it. I agree with him, it is central in Yahadus. Because if you'll ask me what is the quintessence of Jewish history, not only in the past 1900 years, but since the establishment, I would say, this of the Second Commonwealth. It's a story of 2400 years. What is actually, if you want to characterize Jewish history, the motto of Jewish history, what is? What is common to all ages and to all eras? What is it? That verse. Vayovik Ishime Adalisa Shacha. We are always in position, in opposition to something, or rather, somebody or something is in opposition to us. What it is? The issues, there is a number of issues. There was an issue during the Second Commonwealth. It was the issue of Shabbos. The institution of Shabbos was disliked by the Greeks, very disliked by the Romans and Greeks. There was a story circulated in the Near East, that the Jews have in the Holy of the Holies, in the sanctuary, in the Kodesh Kodashim, the head of a donkey. which is worshipped every Yom Kippur when the archpriest enters the Kodesh Kodesh. Of course, I mean, it was such a Alila Saddam. It was, you see, Lashon Hora is a potent weapon. I mean, the rumor was so not annoying, actually constituted a menace to the Jew, that Josephus Flavius wrote a book, Contra Apionem. Appio was the famous anti-Semite Alexandre, where he also, I mean, tries to refute the story about the head of the donkey. The head of the donkey. Yes. Then later in the Middle Ages, later became the problem of the Talmud. The Talmud became the symbol of Jewish uniqueness, which the Christian church hated. How many times did they burn the Talmud? Not only the Talmud, but those who studied the Talmud with the Talmud. Yes. When you say the Talmud, you have a kin of Maram Rutenberg. We say that you keep a salus loop of age, the Shlema Savoyer, the Shlema from Yasser Adroyer. Yeah, Talmud. Then there was the story Matze, blood libel. You don't know how much blood really is spilled for that blood libel story. We have no idea. Later the Jew became the symbol of capitalism, of money, the money lender. This is Shylock, the great Shakespeare, Tzadik Hador. Shylock. Don't think Shylock had a tremendous impact upon the Goyim. Don't fool yourself, Shylock is out. Because it's out, it's more dangerous. Tremendous impact on the Goyim. Because the Jews called Shylock, I mean, I don't know why. But in America they call it Jew Shylock, but I remember as a young boy, Shkotzin used to run after me and call me Shylock. Shylock? They didn't know what Shylock is, but they knew it's a better word anyway. And then the Jew became the representative of capitalism. Marx, the great Marx, who was a Jew himself, says the Jew, the dollar for the Jew, I mean, is his God and so forth. So anyway, now the object of hatred is the state of Israel. The object of hatred is the state of Israel. If an anti-Semite attacks a Jew, is that you cannot attack a Jew. You need a certain objective. The objective is now the state of Israel. It is opposition and intention. And daybreak, I don't know, I don't see it. Daybreak. The morning star will finally rise, but I don't know when, finally. But the whole night. And, of course, we have lost many, we have lost lately 6 million Jews, 1/3 of our population, but on the whole, we emerged victorious. We still retain our identity, we still belong, are committed to the same goal to which our ancestors thousands of years ago, millennia ago, were committed, and we still assemble from time to time and study the Torah. This is Kishomdom Malchus Yovo No Sho Alamcho, which will never sever its affiliation with the Almighty, and who emerged victorious many times from all engagement. So the foolish Malchus Yovo thought, as Brezhnev thinks now, that it's possible to erase that identity. It was a mistake then, it's a mistake now too. All right.